Okay.
We are live.
We are live. But you know
what? Are we taping this?
We are recording this. Okay. And the reason why we're recording this is because it might be a podcast. It might end up being a podcast. So okay. There you go. But welcome everybody who is here, who comes later and who comes now, who's doing it live with us right now and who's later. Today, so you probably usually heard our voices on public intellectual radios, but today is public intellectual, I guess, video cast or whatever. This is part of the Radical December, which is an initiative from the Radical Publishing Alliance. So I'm so excited that Public Intellectuals is part of the Radical Publishing Alliance. Did you know that, Jack?
No, I didn't.
Well, now you do. Now you do. We're part of a club now, and we're part of the Radical Publishing Alliance.
We're in the club.
We're in the club. But, you know, the reason why I kind of did this is because, number one, while I knew we might have a small turnout, I knew we could record it and get people to watch it later on. And that's kind of an important thing. Today, we're talking about, we're just going to, like, kind of jump into it. We're going to talk about Black Radical. Well, actually, no. Black Reconstruction. Reconstruction. The thing is funny is the reason I bring it up. Well, we'll talk about that later. But what do you, and this is Black Reconstruction is a 1935 book that was, well, it was published in 1935 by W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yes.
And it's the Anglo pronunciation of Du Bois. But we're going to start off kind of this conversation with, what do you, you know, Jack, you're from Wisconsin. What do you know about W.E. Du Bois before this book? Don't feel guilty, because the thing is, that's the whole thing. I'm a Black chick from Los Angeles, and you're a white dude from Wisconsin. So what did you know about W.E. Du Bois before this? Like I said, don't be paranoid. Go ahead.
Not much. So, talking about my high school experience, his name was just briefly mentioned as the first person to get a doctorate from Harvard, and then that he
person or first Black person?
First Black person, thank you.
Okay.
To get it from Harvard. And it was seen as, he did this work on history. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. Mm-hmm. We never really went into depth on that. Now, the school actually did have a Black history course in high school. And of course, if you were college bound, you didn't have time to take it. This is kind of the sad reality of it.
Really? If you were college bound, you didn't have time to take Black history?
You really didn't. Well, look, you would have to take certain courses. You need to take a science course. You mm-hmm. need to take a language. You need, and by the time we went through, there wasn't a lot of time for electives. And as a result, there's other things that you probably should be taking. Computer programming, if you're, you know, someone that's going into sciences. So by the time your schedule was all done with all the electives or of all the things that you needed to take to meet the requirements of going to college, the expectations, there wasn't a lot of space left. And for those who were college bound, you had the three histories. You had history of the United States. Mm-hmm. You had a Western civilization. And then it was expected that you would take psychology and sociology. And those would be your social studies classes that you'd be taking. And okay, so you've got your science, you've got your math, you've got your language, you've mm-hmm. got your English, you've got your history. You're now at five. Mm-hmm. And there was also an expectation you'd be in something like band or other things. Okay, there's six. You got seven periods during the day. Do you want to study hall? Yeah, Black history was low on the list of things that I don't think any of my friends actually took it. It was offered, but that was about it. And every once in a while you'd hear people talking about, well, you know, how's it different from American history?
Wow, that was quite a bit of information that I did not know, but thank you for sharing that. Okay. Oddly, I went to a Catholic school, all girls Catholic school. We did not have, at the time, I don't remember us having Black history. But I did know a lot about W.E.B. Du Bois. And the thing that was very interesting is that, as you know, my mother was my mom was kind of a radical in some ways. She was part of Us, which is kind of the opposite of Black Panthers. A lot of people who are in Black Panthers say that Us, they were like informants. I don't think my mom's an informant. No. Kwanzaa that's coming up, they are the kind of group that came up with Kwanzaa. Well, anyway, my whole point was this. My mother was not a fan of W.E. Du Bois. And I now feel that she had an unfair... The thing is that W.E. Du Bois was many people. He wasn't like one dude. Like kind of like you knew him as like, oh, he was the Black guy that graduated from Harvard with a PhD. For me, he was, talented 10th. He was like one of these kind of snobby, uppity, like self-respecting type Black people. That's not me. This is the impression people told me. I'm not saying it. This is what my mother and her friend said. Oh, he's a snob. He doesn't really like Black people, et cetera, et cetera. But as you know, we've read quite a few books during this time.
And we the autobiography of Trotter, or was it the biography
of Trotter? And you know, I'm making sure. Okay, oh, they're listening in. The autobiography of Trotter. We've read this.
Lucy Parsons,
and I've come to find out possibly my mother was wrong. Number one, W.E. Du Bois was. When we went to this book, I was like, oh my God, he's amazing. I already knew that, but my mother had such a kind of this, he was part of the talented 10th, even though that was only a small part of what he did, and was kind of like, oh, Booker T. Washington, he was about self-reliance, et cetera, et cetera. Or Black people do things by themselves. But as you know, when we read the Trotter book, we saw that wasn't quite the case. Segregation wasn't quite the freedom as it appeared to be. The freedom of the cage, the freedom of segregation, which, you know, it's very complicated because you're given such a brief period of Black history. It's like you were slaves, the civil rights movement, everything in between that, there was not much information. Yeah. Sometimes you hear about jazz, that's about it. So I mean, I think the thing that was, you know, for me, with W.E. Du Bois, I thought, oh, you know, he was the snobby one. Booker D. Washington was like the down-to-earth one. But now, like I said, now there's Trotter. He's like the Black radical. So then I realized my whole world got blew up this summer, really. My whole Black world got blew up this summer. And I think it's like, just so you guys know, people who are listening in from the audience, this is actually going to be like a whole month series in January where we're going to be talking to different academics, different philosophers, different poets, and we're going to go through this entire book, which is, oh my goodness, this book is 700 pages. And it is not the easiest of reads.
It's comprehensive.
And I don't mean like, oh, it's like, I mean, it's an amazing book. I mean, I think the thing that I thought about this book was, that was amazing, was it was historical, but it had poetry, it had fiction, it had everything.
Well, it had sociology. It's a description of life during that period. And I'm bringing up this point early, but I think it also should be brought up. In the beginning of this book, and we'll get to this very, very soon, by the time W.E.B. Du Bois is writing, sorry, I did the French version of it, Du Bois.
Du Bois.
So this is what happens when you take French. Okay. You start to pronounce things. By the time he was written, there was already a narrative on Reconstruction. And you can see it most vilely in A Birth of a Nation, the popularization of that horrible, horrible vision. So he had to do a lot of work. And being as someone from the sciences, the person I'm really familiar with is Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species is a long, comprehensive book. And what Darwin was trying to do was basically convince people that were dead set against evolution, or at least give a really compelling one for the people that were in between. And there weren't many in between. Mm-hmm. So Darwin writes this enormous book, and he probably still would have been writing in 1859 if he hadn't almost been scooped by Alfred Wallace, who, you know, is this. And then, so the point is Darwin writes a big tome because he's got to go against millennia of discussion of deist-based ideas on the origin of life. And likewise, W.E.B. was doing something similar. This is why the book is so comprehensive, but also kind of daunting. When you see a book that big, you're thinking Joyce, you're thinking Kant, you're thinking some large tome that you have to be intellectually ready for. And I'd say it's more of just being ready to hear a very detailed and comprehensive discussion or argument. And that's what it is.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that's really about this. What they say, okay, I'm going to kind of start like one of the lines of W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, 1935. The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, and then moved back towards slavery. I think for me, because he goes over a period from 1860 to 1880. And for me, being an African-American, my family going back to at least the 1700s, and getting pieces of this story, but it not being the main Black story. And also because you get Birth of a Nation and you have the, what do you call it? The Dunning interpretation. What's it called? It's called something. What's it called? It was something was called the Dunning School of Reconstruction, yeah. Which viewed the failure. Okay. Was it a failure? Cause that's the whole thing. Was Reconstruction a failure? What went on there? But also too, and I kind of want to go back before we get too deep into the book, because this book is huge. So like I said, this is going to actually kind of be, this is kind of an overview of what we're going to be talking about in January. So you have a-
Can I jump in briefly?
Sure, go ahead.
What I was going to say is that in some sense, one of the things we're going to argue is that Reconstruction was murdered. It was lynched. I'm going to use those loaded terms. It was lynched deliberately. Murdered. And the Dunning School is going to portray it as at very best self-defense, and they're just going to basically suggest that the freed slaves fell down the stairs. That's what they argue. They weren't ready and they just fell down the stairs. They were pushed, beaten, burnt, and then dumped in the river. That's what happened at Reconstruction. You had individuals that were ready. And this is something else that's going to be amazing in this Black Reconstruction, is that he's going to show you that these folks, for all the chains that they had shed, they were ready to have their own lives. They were ready to live it. You know, And the reality was that they were stymied at almost every occasion that they were able to maintain power or autonomy for any period of time. It's in many ways a miracle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of like, you know, his, you know, I like the fact, like I said, I'm going to go back to that. We're going to go back into the book in a moment, but we want to talk about the struggles he had just getting this book made, because they didn't even want, this book got made for this reason. He wrote something for the Britannica,
Encyclopedia Britannica.
Encyclopedia Britannica. And it said, let's see here. The reason why they didn't publish it is because he said in the final exchange of letters from its editor, the boys refused to allow Britannica to publish his article unless the two following sentences were included. White historians have ascribed the faults and failures of Reconstruction to Negro ignorance and corruption, but the Negro insists that it was the Negro loyalty and Negro vote alone that restored the South to the Union, established a democracy both for white and black, and instituted the public schools. So editor F.H. Hooper regretted that he could not publish that. He said no. And I think the thing that's just, for me, so shocking is like, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica, that is kind of like the standard that we all use in order, I'm at the tail end of Generation X. I still used Encyclopedia Britannica when I was like, I'm thinking junior high to do some things. I mean, we still have the computer, but the fact that it was, I know now we know, of course, academia is biased. Obviously, they're biased. How do we not know that? But at the time, I think as a child and you're looking through it, you're like, well, you know, of course, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica, it's just a book. It's completely objective.
Well, we even think that it's because it says Britannica, this was a British publication. However, by, I believe it's 1901, it already moved its offices to the United States. This is something that, you know, you might consider false advertising. Encyclopedia Britannica starts in Scotland, but by 1901, it's now it's been bought up by an American firm, I believe, by 1911. I'm looking at another encyclopedia, a naughty one, Wikipedia, for the quick story of this. So you're probably wondering, where did he get this information from? Well, 1901 is when it's picked up, and then the offices are moved. The 11th edition is 1911. It's now firmly in the United States. So, you know, you would think, oh, well, you know, the British, they ended slavery in 1847. They're going to be a more neutral party. No, this is an American publication. They're just putting British in there to, you know, make it seem more civilized and have more gravis.
And I think another thing that shocked me reading this book is that I didn't realize how closely the South and Britain were kind of like, they were, the British viewed the English, maybe that should be the term, the English viewed the South as more of their kind of people than the people from the North. Because they viewed the people from the South, they had class, they knew how to like, you know, sit down and have nice dinners. I guess in New York was like King of New York. I guess that kind of situation was going on. Gangs in New York situation was going on.
England was dealing with its own issues of class. And the upper classes are always going to stick together. And mm-hmm. the slavery allowed for basically the skimming and surplus labor off of all these slaves and into the pockets of some rich landowner. And in some sense, that's the story of England as well. It's not so much slaves, it's you know, the landed gentry and others. Now, this is something that is, many people forget, is that the UK was going through its own issues like this, labor issues. And Liverpool, interestingly, the worker associations in Liverpool, I don't know if they're quite yet unions, because I think unions were banned at that point. And here's where I've got a hole in my knowledge. I'm trying to remember from college. But they, at one point, threatened to strike and not unload Southern cotton. And this was part of the reason why the UK didn't immediately come out and recognize the South. It's because the workers in the UK realized that their abilities would be undercut if the slavery was allowed to continue, and especially if all this cheap cotton is coming in. So in many ways, their solidarity was one of the reasons why the UK didn't go in, because they would have then had to deal with a real problem. and they didn't want, you know, you don't want to fight two wars at the same time. And there were a whole lot of things that are going on that we, you know, when we're talking about Reconstruction, we also need to talk about the invasion of Mexico by France. This went on at the same time. We also need to talk about Louis Riel's revolution going on in what's now Manitoba. You know, there was calls for Canadian independence. So all these things kind of played out. And this is part of probably the reason why France and the UK did not recognize the South, even though they would have wanted to, just one, for cheap cotton, and two, to break up the power of the United States. So there's little things on here in the background that we tend to forget as America, because we like to put our boundaries. You know, you've got the boundary on the north, and you have the boundary at the Rio Grande and the Gadsden Cross. And what happens up in Canada? Oh, they're too nice. What happens down in Mexico? Oh, it's you know, it's unknowable. But these were major events that were going on during this whole period. And this is part of the reason why, as I said, France and UK did not get involved, though they may have wished.
I think that was something that was kind of shocking to me, because I guess, you know, I mean, as a person like in the United States, you just think, oh, okay, well, you know what it is, because we have a certain, there are two things going on in the South. You know, there's one part of the South that's, you know, we view it as.
Well, as you pointed out, there's actually several Souths there.
Yeah.
There's the New Orleans experience, which mm-hmm. came out of a more Creole culture that was more willing to admit, hey, I've got kids that are darker skin than me. And yeah. Why is that? Oh, but you also have this planter culture, and you also have this Appalachian Hill culture, which were opposed to the rich planters. And in fact, the most successful rebellion of that was West Virginia, breaking loose from Virginia. So there's, and this is something that I actually liked about W.E.B. Du Bois. Boy, I still can't get away from that.
That's okay. Okay. Just
keep moving. But, and a lot of histories are almost taught in this dialectic, Hegelian dialectic. And what he was pointing out was, is there was actually multiple groups that were all in competition. And sometimes you had the planters after the war, planters working with the freed slaves, and other times the planters were working with the whites. And during brief periods, there was even slaves working with the freed whites, though unfortunately that boy, there could have been some amazing work had those.
I think that was one thing that's interesting in the book. He had separate categories. I mean, he talked about the planter class, the poor whites, the poor blacks, or the black worker, the free blacks, the white worker. He even talked about the Chinese worker, which they called the coolie at the time. I thought it was really interesting that it was about race, but it was also very much about class. This book was very much, it had a lot to do with class struggle. And when you read it, you're kind of, for me, it was kind of heartbreaking, because you could see how the wealthy got in there. Because the thing is that, you know, as slavery grew, and as slavery ended, they could have done a lot of things.
Yeah.
They could have done a lot of things. Even W.E. Du Bois said that 40 acres, poor white people should have gotten something too. And the thing is that, kind of in a way, by the rich white planters, by them kind of not bringing that up, they were able to kind of pit poor white people and poor, it's not so much from the East Coast or the North, but from the South, because those people could have worked together. Poor white people and poor black people from the South could have actually worked together. And they kind of did this narrative. Well, that's the whole thing I think is interesting about the South, is that we have so many great storytellers from the South, and they really use that storytelling ability to their advantage in this game. They essentially retold, reimagined Jedi mind trick, reworked everything. I mean, after you finish talking to someone, after you finish talking to somebody from the South, you think, well, they weren't that bad. But when you read this book, you see how ugly and awful the South was. I mean, like I said, we couldn't discuss this book in like one hour, like I said, or even with one person, because it's too massive and too. Go ahead.
We need a miniseries. It's like, let's get our society has come into the half-hour sitcom that's actually 20 minutes, and everything's resolved. Or the movie in which they'll take a ponderous tome and they'll try and turn it into a single three-hour movie max, or maybe a sequel. That's, you know, there is a lot of material here to discuss and to talk about. And as you said, the narrative was completely rewritten to the point where the South seemed sympathetic. And I have to say, when I was reading this, there were times where I started to think they should have driven those Southern planters and their supporters into the sea with bayonets. They should have driven them into the sea. I was that angry. Well, I was that enraged.
Well, it's an enraging book, because you see how they were allowed to do, you know, how to economically disempower. They were, I mean, put it this way, if you read inside the book, and we're not telling you things that you don't know, but they were, like, essentially after slavery was over, things that they did after slavery was over. And the thing is, this is kind of interesting, because there are things that, you know, if you're African American, there's a lot of conversations that happen. And before I kind of go into this, I'm going to kind of talk about the first chapter, and I'm just going to read the beginning of, you know, of the first, not the beginning, but like the thing he said about Black workers. That's chapter one. How Black men. Woo.
Can I jump in?
Sure, go
because
ahead.
You pointed out that some people, when they start to learn about this, they talk about Southern terrorism. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this idea of terrorism as a means of asymmetric warfare. You have a smaller group versus a larger group, and so they use these terroristic activities. This wasn't terrorism. This was annihilation. It would be like saying, oh, I'm trying to think of, try not to go for the easy examples, mm-hmm. but this was liquidation. This was not your random acts of violence. They never are, but this was not random acts of a violence of a lesser versus a, no, this was sheer domination. And as I said, by the time I was done reading this novel, my sympathy for the South is gone. And to say that I was angry and filled at times with rage, I had to stop listening to this in the car because it was affecting my driving. I could feel the anger flowing through me. It's kind of, you know, the Sith, I feel the anger. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'm gonna get into a car wreck if I keep listening to this stuff, because it's making me that angry. And I can feel myself wanting to react harshly. So I'll stop.
No, that's okay. No. I mean, like I said, it's very upsetting. And like I said, I'm going to talk about some things that you brought up. Chapter one was The Black Worker. And it says, how Black men coming to America in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries became a central thread in the history of the United States. At once a challenge to a democracy, and always as an important part of this economic history and social development. Another thing they said, some things I pulled out, the Black worker in 1860, 11% of 11% of the Black people were free. Black people are free Black workers. 90% of the Black people were born in the United States, and most were descendants from the West Coast of Africa, though they were from everywhere in Africa. As you know, I just found out my family's history. I got some information here from the African American family, and it finds out that my people are in Guinea-Bissau, and let's see here, and Sierra Leone and Senegal. And that's what he said that the people came from, which I thought was interesting because we were going to go over this. But I remember I had, I was at an NAACP, and as you know, my politics were not the same as NAACP, but they let me watch this free movie, right? So what could I do? Anyway, so I'm watching this movie, and the actors are there, and everyone's kind of like African-American, and everyone's saying, my family was free, my family was free, my family was free, and in my own head, I'm like, you know, as an African-American, we all say our family was one of the free families, okay? And I said, there are three things going on. One, everybody who's part of the free families, we are all in one little circle, so our circle's small, so we all gonna know each other because we're all like one community. Two, people are lying. And three, people were lied to because they were ashamed or embarrassed or for any variety of reasons. I mean, the same thing, the same reason. And I think another thing that's interesting in this book is it's 1935. W.E. Du Bois mentioned all the mixed race children. He mentioned all the biracial children that you see on the plantation. Like, these children look just as you know. My mother's family were the second family of a planter in New Orleans. And this is a known fact, which is why we could, we go back so far as white people. But they act like those people do not exist. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because of the Native American quote unquote lie that people often bring up. And the reason they say they are, I used to really make fun of people who are black, who would say I'm part Cherokee, I'm part this, I'm part that, in regards to being Native American. Then I realized they were saying they were Native American because it sounded better than saying that they were raped by a white master. That sounds like a better story that you're going to pass down to your children than, I'm not saying that there weren't people who were Native American. I'm not saying that because clearly there were, but that's also go ahead.
Going back to some of the history of our country that isn't talked about, we like to talk about the great men and the great wars and things like that, but there were other things going on as well. And a graphic artist by the name of Timothy Truman has revisited the story of Simon Girty. You may know Simon Girty from The Jury of the Damned in the Devil versus Daniel Webster, in which Simon Girty, the white renegade who whooped and screamed as white men burned. Girty was captured by the Shawnee and then raised as a Shawnee, as a replacement child for a Shawnee child that died. And his white family had beat him. They treated him really poorly. And suddenly the Shawnee, they've made him one of his own. They treated him well. They never raised a hand against him. And it wasn't just white individuals that were captured and adopted. It was also African-American individuals. And yes, they did own slaves. They owned other Native American groups and African-American groups. And they, if you're a white person that was an older male and they were kind of pissed at you, you might be kept as a captive. Sam Kenton is a classic example of that. But going back to this, why? Why did Sam Houston like this, that talk about his time is with the Cherokee? Because they treated you better. The white authorities in this country treated people poorly, especially working class people. And a lot of people like to say, oh, as a Native American, because I think we forget they treated their people very, very well. If you were in the group, they treated you well. If you're outside of the group, oh, don't hunt on their land. You are in trouble. But as I said, within our society, within the in-group, you had a lot of mistreatment of people. But within the Native Americans, and I'm not going to glorify them, but I will say they treated their people well. And they also treated whites and African Americans as equals. And you don't see that in other groups. And this is why when they did the prisoner exchanges, the whites tried to go back to their Native American families. The Native American families never went back. They never went back to their white families, ever.
Well, I mean, so, I think that's like I said. I'm hoping to get a scholar. I'm not gonna say their name because they have not confirmed. But and that was another thing too. I really want to know the Native perspective of this book, because they're talking about giving away. You know, oh, we could have given land to the white people. Our poor white people give land to the poor black people. Well, whose land was that? I'm interested in how natives interpret this book. I'm also interested in how, you know, he didn't really go into, oh, he said, I thought another thing that was interesting about this book is they talked about Texas and they said, you know, and he's like, yeah, Texas you weren't treated, but they said that Texas, they weren't as bad as, my whole point was this. We're talking about after people got free from slavery, and I'm talking about how the whole African-American story. And we're just like, after slavery, I would have just left, right? I would have just left. And like, why didn't you leave? Like, what's wrong with you? Why didn't people leave? And it's you hear this casualness within the African-American community about, you know, kind of like this poo-pooing people who didn't leave. Like, oh, they should have left. Oh, this person should have left. And kind of like,
it's like what happened to Anne Frank. They should have left. Yeah, well, the U.S. wouldn't give them a visa.
Well, the thing is, this is what happened. You know, when I was reading it, you're like, oh yeah, people after slavery, what they tried to do after Emancipation Proclamation, and they tried to walk off the plantation, they would like cut off people's ears, cut off people's noses, disfigure them, and send them back to the plantation. Yeah. So it wasn't, and they were like, and then they had to work for the person that they had that was formerly their master.
And had to do year-long contracts. And we heard some horror stories of slaves being, ex-slaves being beaten as if they still were, you know, beaten very, very badly. But, you know, here's one of the problems, you know, go where? They talked about Canada. Canada's a long ways away. And they talked about Mexico. Mexico is in the middle of a civil war. And it's a dry and often unhospitable place. You're going to an entirely new country with different languages that you're not probably familiar with. Maybe someone from New Orleans could get away with Spanish because the Spanish had controlled New Orleans for a while. But come on, you know, you're going to learn a new language and you're going to establish yourself in a country in which you have no, you know, no resources, no support. I don't want to say the Mexicans wouldn't have accepted freed slaves, but I will point out that Maximilian attempted to have the country colonized by Europeans. So he was trying to bring over whites especially from the Austro-Hungarian Empire and France as well, because his patron was Napoleon III. But the point is where are you going to go? West onto Native American lands. And at that point, the Apaches, the Cheyenne, and the Sioux were in a midst for fighting for their lives, so they were not going to just give it up. So where are you going to go? West, and you've been disarmed, or south, and you're going to have to learn a new language, or north. Good luck getting there. You've got an entire country to go through, and most of them are quite hostile.
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of like this whole, I mean, I think in a way, like as I've gotten older, I'm less likely to just kind of like, oh, well, they just didn't really try. I never thought that way anyway, but now I'm going to actually kind of argue with people, you know, people who were like, you know, the formerly enslaved Africans that, you know, that are kind of like, oh, now what do you do at this point? And the thing is, that's another thing too. I remember I was telling someone, I said, you know, most, because they were talking about the South and COVID-19, and they were like, well, I don't really care. And I said, you know, most Black people live in the South. And they're like, what? And it was a white man, as yourself, did not know. This is a white man with a PhD at a major university. And I was like, how could you not know that? I mean, but of course, why would you know? Why was this is kind of, maybe it's random information, but most Black people did not get out of the South because 90% of Black people who were born in the United States, at least in 1860, were in the South. So, you're still going to be there. I mean, still, there's still, that's still a large chunk of us are still there. But I think another thing is I'm going to go to chapter 2 really quick. The white, because I think we only, we're just doing a brief overview. The white worker, how America became labor's promised land, and flocking here from the world, white workers competed with black slaves and new floods of foreigners and growing exploitations until they fought slavery to save democracy and lost democracy in a new, vaster slavery. And they're just talking about the labor union, the movement, and the unions, which we still have issues with today. I think I know that you're very into the unions. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because I know you're interested in.
Well, one of the cool things that Du Bois.
Oh, yeah, you got it.
Du Bois. Got it. This is not deliberate. For those of you out there who are used to white people screwing up names, I'm not trying to do this. Having gone through the entire book, I really have respect for the man. And so when you hear me screw this up, I'm sorry. This is, je m'appelle, this is my French talking. But going back to this, there was some real fights going on, especially between the working class that was in the mines, out in the timberlands, doing work in the farms, in the factories as well. And here's something that kind of leads to our issues today. There was, when this country was first starting out, and we had in some ways swindled a lot of the land weight from the Native Americans, there was always an outlet for the person that would have caused real trouble in another country, like Poland, occupying Poland or UK or other things. It was the farm option. Here you go. Here's your claim. You're going to get 40 acres. You have to work it for a couple of years. And what we're going to do is we're going to take all those folks that might otherwise be a real problem, rebellious-wise, and we're going to give them an outlet that you can just go off and you'll have your own farm and no one's going to tell you what to do. And if you succeed, good for you. And if you fail, well, that's your problem. You obviously don't know what you're doing, and you can slouch back to work at the factory for the same crappy wage. So there was a lot of fights going on right now, but as he points out, the outlet was the West. And you wrote that article on little libertarians on the West. Even today I have friends and acquaintances that are libertarian that they just want to get away from it all. They're gonna hop in a boat and they're gonna sail west. Well, where? This kind of, all the places that humans could live without a great amount of energy have been occupied since at the very end, 800 AD. So that's when the Maori found New Zealand. Ever since then, every place has been taken. Where are you going to go? And so this is kind of one of the big issues that comes out of this, is that for the white rebellious worker, there was always that out of go west. And in fact, the U.S. uses that at the end. This is how they deal with also some of their rowdy ex-Confederates. You can go out west, as long as you weren't an officer. You too, as a Southerner, could get some land or a mine claim or other things like that. So those were always the options out. But those options were not made. And so the whole discussion of 40 acres and a mule, the 40 acres, well, you had to provide your own meal, but the 40 acres you could get if you were white, but it wasn't made available to those who are black. And this is kind of, one of the big issues is the vagrancy laws, which are still a problem today, have been applied to keep people under control and working at shit wages. And you did have the option to go west. So this was domination. This wasn't terrorism. This wasn't just a misjustice. This was domination. Okay, I can't hear you.
I know, I saw that. I think that was one thing that was just so disturbing to me, was that also too, this book made very clear the connection between slavery and prison. Like, the if you want to see the beginning of the slavery of enslavement of Black people to the prison industrial complex, this book is the it's like the blueprint. Like if you can read all books you want to, but if you want to see how it started, read this book, because he actually goes into detail. Like, oh, well, you were enslaved, and now they made this law that if you don't have a job, but if you just became free, why would you have a job? You just got free, so you're, of course, oh, now you're a slave again. And it's like, oh, and now you're in jail. Now you're in a cage. Go ahead.
So you broke the law by the Vagrancy Act. You are required to have this. Otherwise, we're going to send you to jail, and then they're going to sell your labor out. You know, in the North, we always kind of viewed those chain gangs as some sort of weird Southern kind of, nastiness. And upon reading this, I'm starting to realize, oh my God, those chain gangs were deliberate throwbacks to slavery. They were deliberately doing this to emphasize your position in society. You know, you're back to being a slave. And we got you, and we'll kill you if you get out of line. You know, the old Southern sheriff with the shotgun that, you know, if you didn't like how you looked at him with they'd shoot you. Yeah.
I mean, to watch, I think the thing is too, that people kind of think, oh, you don't mean exactly like that, right? You mean like in theory, it's like it's like slavery. And then when you read this, you're like, no, not in theory. This actually happened. Like, this is actually happening right now. And I think that's something that this book points out. Oh, another thing, because like I said, we only got like 10 more minutes left, but we were talking about the fact that they said that the left was concerned, because the left was concerned, whatever the left was being called at that point, if we keep, we keep changing our names, that it was a Black, he was becoming too Black nationalist. And what were we saying about, if you read this book, you can realize that if you essentially the whole country, and it still is, a white nationalist country. It was literally like he couldn't be anything but a Black nationalist, because anything that wasn't white people are great. And the thing is that it was on the left, it was on the right, it was in the North, it was in the West, it was everywhere. It was this idea. I mean, and even like as we got towards the end of the book, when Black people owned things, they got so upset. Like, Black people couldn't have bicycles because then it would get killed. Black people couldn't have businesses because if they did well, they had to hide it. If they got educated, they had to hide that too. If they had a business, they would get pissed off and like burn it down. Like, they would just, in the South, so people figured out how to own land. Like, say like some of the masters gave their formerly enslaved African people or formerly enslaved people land, and they had farms, and other white people went and killed them. And yeah. it was Drove literally like you, I mean, literally, if you weren't like on a chain gang or sweeping someone's house, or as I say too, he was very open. He's like, oh, and they were raping people. I mean, it doesn't keep in mind, this is 1935.
The rapes never apparently stopped. And this is kind of the horridness of the South. If a white woman was seen with a Black man, there was trouble. Look at what happened with the Scottsboro case right there, in which there was no rape that took place. The women eventually admitted that they were forced to make the accusations. You know, think about that. You have people on a train, and these women are found with these young African-American men, and they're forced to make a rape claim so that the people can be brought up and given the cap punishment. Now, luckily, these young men were not killed, but if you were white and you raped a Black woman, there was almost no consequence. But if you were Black and found in the context of a white woman, look at Emmett Till. You know, look at the Scottsboro boys. And this is what, as in the 20th century, as we go and revisit a lot of the injustices that occur in the South, they're starting to realize that legally and illegally, we lynched people, African-Americans, left, right, and center. You know,
I think the thing is, too, that's interesting is that a lot of people, you know, the people who are getting lynched were business owners. They were exactly. The people who were getting lynched were the people who could read, the people who were like the political agitators.
The preachers.
Yes.
That horrible story about the guy who was beaten so badly he couldn't crawl back into his house and they left him out in the winter to die.
I mean, yeah. It was, this is, like I said, this is a historical book, but it's like a nightmare. I mean, I'm literally like still having disturbing thoughts about this book because number one is huge, so you read it and you get really into it. So you really start. The details.
Lots of stories.
Extreme graphic detail that maybe you don't want to know, but you should know. I mean, okay, I want to go back to the prison situation. In 1883, 10% of Alabama's total revenue was derived from renting prisoners. By 1898. 73% of their entire revenue. And Alabama was a place that was cutting off people's ears when they tried to leave.
Oh, this is once again, you know, some of the real frustrations I have, especially with conservatives, with the whole idea of, well, you know, if we cut our, you know, tighten our belts enough. No, these groups, the reason why they were making so much money off of African-American prisoners was this, they didn't want to pay taxes. And the white planters gotten into an agreement with the poor whites that they would, all the things that they were required to do for black people in terms of education and other things like that, they were going to cut it to the bone. And they were, you know, low taxes. Well, where's the money going to come from? For those of you out there that are conservative, I've got a phrase for you. Tans to full. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. In this case, Alabama's free lunch, it was coming off of neo-slave labor. You know, so.
No, I have to say this. This book was kind of a nightmare. I don't want to.
Kind of a nightmare?
No.
As I said,
I had
to pull over the side of the road. I was ready to.
There were there's an audio version of this book, and I'll tell you something. This book as an audio, oh my gosh, it's so entertaining. Like I said, it's horrible. Yeah. It's a horrible book, and you're going to be like, not horrible in regards to what happened was horrible, but say you got the audio version of this, because to me, the audio with the actual like hand in your held book, it's so his rhythm as far as writing, as far as technique, he's an amazing writer. I don't know anyone who could tell this story at this length and it still be, oh my God, this is an amazing book that is about, you know, about Marxism, class struggle, racism, poor black people, poor white people, the planter's class.
And it's some of the history that you missed. Once again, I'm thinking about myself and I'd read the ABC of Color and I read a couple of other things. Compared to your typical white person, I probably know a little bit more about the African-American historical experience than many people do. I know about the Buffalo Soldiers on bicycles and things like that, fun stuff. But boy, I wasn't ready for this. I mean, I had bad associations with the South and Reconstruction and the Klan and things like that. But not until I heard this did I, you know, my bad associations and you know, vague unease become hardened into just anger. Now, for those of you out there in TV land also, Lark, hold up the size of that book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Most people see a book about this size and kind of go, ooh, this better be Game of Thrones. And the reality is it's probably a good idea to get this as an audio book. you can do it as you're driving or maybe some other hobby. It's worth listening to, because here's something else. There are going to be points where you're going to need to stop. And there are going to be other points where you're going to be so sad, so angry, so emotional, you're going to need someone else to turn the page. So these are good reasons to read this as an audiobook. It's going to help you get through that without having to spend all of your attention on that. And that also, the fact that you are going to be able to drive or do something else is going to allow you at least a little bit of distance that you may need to get through this book. And there are going to be times where you're going to want to put it down and not come back, because you know what's going to be on the next page and it's going to be awful. But if you're willing to, for those of you who really want to understand the history of this country, get through it.
Yeah,
what is it? It's January 1st is coming through, the resolution. Here's your resolution.
Here's your resolution. And, you know, with that, like I said, we're going to release in a little bit the people who are going to be part of the series that's going to start on January 2nd and go every single Saturday, 2nd, 9th, 11th, for five Saturdays, because the book is huge. So we have to like break it down. And the thing is that you can come and like watch the podcast, you can participate, et cetera, because we're going to have it on Zoom. We're going to have a podcast. We're going to replay it. And also another thing that's very interesting is that we are I'm participating in the John Brown, W.E. Du Bois, John Brown book reading. That's going to start tomorrow. We'll probably put that up, whatever. But I think it's going to be a good compliment, because now I know why W.E. Du Bois wrote John Brown. He was trying to really get white people to kind of go, see, you can help too. You can do this. He was trying to encourage white people. I mean, that's what I think. After I read this, I'm like, oh, I see why he wrote John Brown now. I completely understand how that happened. He thought, well, after he figured out all this information, he was like, how can I win over poor white people? Mm-hmm. Because in this book, it's really heartbreaking. You see how poor white people really did cut off their noses to spite their face.
Their faces.
And it was so many opportunities. And that just...
And that's something that I have to admit really, really frustrates me. There were opportunities, but the South, the power centers in the South really did an excellent job in destroying those. And to talk about Texas, you know, one of the things that many people don't realize about Texas is that the Cherokee, one group of Cherokee actually went there. And then when the rowdy and dangerous Texans drove them out, they went to Mexico. But there was this whole group of pacifist Germans that went to Texas, and they were unionists. And they were slaughtered in several different incidences. There was one where they hanged over 100 of them from trees. There's another one where they attempted to escape to Mexico and they were run down by the Texas Rangers. This is part of the reason why when I hear Texas Rangers, I'm also kind of
we realize the Texas Rangers were really horrible. I mean, even in this book, they reference the Texas Rangers, and they were essentially just people who killed black people. And I guess Germans, pacifist Germans.
Pacifist Germans that just wanted to go to Mexico. So the point is that the power groups really went out of their way to, one, make sure that poor white people understood that they'd better stay apart from these slaves, that their poverty was partially due to the fact that these slaves were having a better life on the plantation than they were. And they created this nasty conflict. And had the slaves, former slaves, got together with those poor blacks, the interesting immigrants in the form of the pacifist Germans, who were also all the radicals that were pushed out in 1848, and then the carpetbaggers, the educated African Americans and sympathetic whites that came south, something good could have happened. But from our standpoint of the story, and not to give you a spoiler alert, they lost.
Yes, they lost. But we can say we hope you join us. Thank you so much, Jack, for joining us. And thank all of you who did listen in. Like I said, the podcast will go up as an audio. But again, thank you so much. And I hope that you guys join us at publicintellectuals.org. We update every day. We have a radio show, this show. We do book groups. We have a forum. You don't have to put your name. You can just put guest and just sign in and talk to people.
Guest or create the nom de plume that you desire. Notice it is proper French pronunciation.
All right. So thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.